Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Today we'll discuss joint enterprise, a legal doctrine which many think has led to miscarriages of justice. I'm joined to discuss this by my co-presenter Rob Allen and by two experts. Jan Cunliffe is with me. Her son Jordan was imprisoned for murder under joint enterprise. She's now director of the campaign group Jengba. Nisha Waller is doing a PhD on joint enterprise and racism. Rob, you know, joint enterprise is something talked about a lot now, but it goes back a long way, doesn't it? There was a case of Derek Bentley. Can you explain that one?
Well, I think I first became aware of the doctrine when I saw a film called Let Him Have It, which is about the Derek Bentley case. This was in the 1950s. He was a young man who was convicted of murdering a police officer and actually hanged following conviction, although he did not fire the gun which killed the police officer. A younger boy did that, and he went to prison rather than face the death penalty. And the film is all about the difficulties and the apparent injustice of the case. So I was quite surprised when more recently the issue has been debated so heavily that it was still something that is in the law.
So Nisha and Jan, in order to kind of explain joint enterprise, I wonder if you can give an example of a person convicted under joint enterprise where you think the conviction was unjust. Nisha, can you give an example?
Yeah, so a young man that I interviewed recently who is serving more than 20 years, he was in the back of a vehicle traveling with his friend who was driving. There was a second vehicle with another group of people, some of whom he knew but was not close friends with. The vehicle that he was not in had spotted somebody that they obviously had previous conflict with, and they had jumped out and run into a housing estate. Shortly after, both vehicles drove off. This young man who was in the back of the car was asleep, and in fact his co-defendant that I also spoke to said exactly the following words to me. He said, "My co-defendant was given a life sentence for sleeping in the back of my car."
So he was asleep in the back of the van while somebody from another van got out and killed somebody?
Yeah, another vehicle, yeah.
So how did they connect him with the murder?
It was constructed around a gang narrative. So the prosecution claimed that they were all part of the same gang and therefore had a common intention. And the young man described to me how they drew on this gang narrative to imply that he must have known what was going to happen. He must have known that the others in the other vehicle had a knife, and he must have wanted that to also happen.
Jan, can you give an example?
They're all pretty much the same, believe it or not. I mean, my son's case is the obvious and the easiest one for me to talk about. You know, a blind 15-year-old neither took part in the violence nor saw the violence. And yet he's convicted of murder on the possibility of foresight. The weakness of the evidence that the prosecutor uses is so unbelievable that if we told the public about it, they would think that we were telling lies. The evidence used in these cases are not about forensic evidence or blood spatter or gun residue on your hands. They're about who your friends are. Do you know them? You must all be bad people. So therefore, if one of your number does something bad, you're all in it together. And juries are being convinced of this. There are many laws out there that can be used to find out a person's culpability or guilt. We don't have to use the laziness of joint enterprise. But yet, it's very easy to get a conviction by using this because the prosecution doesn't need any firm or any solid or any real evidence at all.
So, Jan, what we have then with joint enterprise is a group of people who are basically accused of the same crime, even though one person probably, as it were, wielded the knife. But they're all accused of the same crime, aren't they?
Yeah. And the other thing that people don't realise is they're getting the same life sentence as the perpetrator. It's wrong on so many levels. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, part of the problem is with the murder cases is that we have this compulsory life sentence. I mean, obviously, there can be different levels of tariff, the length of time that people have to spend in prison as part of that life sentence. That can be varied. But some of the cases I've heard about, people who are involved on this secondary basis have had extremely long sentences imposed on them, young men who basically feel it's unfair. And many of those who work with them, their families, their friends, feel it's unfair. That's not to say that they shouldn't have been some sort of consequence, but it seems completely disproportionate. Is that your view, Nisha?
Yeah. And just to add, I've been speaking to a number of young black men convicted under joint enterprise in recent years, and almost all of them have been given sentences longer than they've been alive. I spoke to a young man, he's 21 now. He was charged when he was 16 and he was given an 18-year sentence. Now, he admitted to being at the scene, he didn't have a knife on him and he didn't inflict any violence. His sentence appeal was upheld, so he will serve the 18 years. And it's just absolutely mad how we're responding to a certain level of harm with even more harm.
I mean, I think one thing just to kind of establish is that there are cases where somebody admits to actually wielding the knife or stabbing the person, and there's a group with them, and yet that group can still, even though somebody's admitted it, be all convicted of murder. So Jan, I just wonder if you can explain that in the Jack Woodley case. So Jack was a teenager who was murdered, and 10 teenagers were convicted of his murder.
I prefer to call them children because they were children. They were all at school. A tragic case where an 18-year-old is stabbed, but there was only one boy that had a knife that night, and he did the stabbing. He wasn't very well known to the other children because he'd moved to the area, so they didn't know that he had a knife or that he would use it. He pleaded guilty, didn't blame any of the others, but the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, thought it was more appropriate to charge 10 children with murder than to take the plea of the one that had actually committed the murder.
So there are lots of cases then of joint enterprise where one person actually has admitted to wielding a knife.
There are many. There are so many like that. There are also cases where the perpetrator can get manslaughter and his co-defendants get murder. It doesn't always make any sense whatsoever. Our campaign have got people who are the perpetrator and they've been acquitted, and yet their co-defendants are now serving life sentences of 24 years plus, and they didn't lay a finger on the victim. I mean, we can argue that this isn't doing any victim's family any good. This is causing them harm as well. People who've been affected by a murder or violence want the truth. They don't want innocent people to be serving decades for a crime they haven't committed. They want the person that did it. They want resolution, and they never get it.
But Nisha, presumably there are cases where one person wields the knife and there are others who are genuinely complicit or have set it up or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who do assist or encourage someone else to commit an offence. But it's about where we draw that line. So what actually constitutes assistance or encouragement? I'm yet to come across a case with Jengba or my research where I think, yeah, that is clear assistance or encouragement. That's not to say there aren't any. And obviously we deal with people who are challenging their conviction. So it's more likely that they would be on the periphery of an offence or had very little physical involvement. But there is an issue with the law in that nobody knows what constitutes assistance or encouragement. The law is not clear on that. And so people are being convicted for doing absolutely nothing. And how do you prove someone's intention when they've not committed any physical act? And how the prosecution construct that intent is by relying on myths and stereotypes about young people, specifically young Black people. And they draw on their character. They draw on things like their involvement with the production of drill music. So I think they're convincing juries by tapping into myths and stereotypes. They build an image of a criminal character that convinces a jury, and that's why juries convict.
And we've got to add as well that when these trials are taking place, we've got local media as well as national newspapers churning out the prosecution's side, never the defence side, with photographs which are police station mugshots. You know, if it's a multi-handed case, and particularly when it's with young Black men, they'll have, you know, 9-10 Black faces on the front page of the national newspapers calling them gang members. And at that point, no one's actually proven whether they are in a gang or not. It's just they must be.
Mm. I mean, Jan, partly down to your campaign, this issue has had a lot of coverage over the last 10 or 15 years. In that period, has the prosecution been using this kind of approach more aggressively than in the past? Is it something that they, do you think, have decided to do to try and charge at the highest level?
I think they've always done it. And it depends who they're prosecuting. It depends where those young people live. There are cases where people could come from sort of inner city areas where they'll swoop up everyone.
I mean, in terms of this joint enterprise in general, it's obviously a legal doctrine that can apply in all sorts of cases. We've been discussing the most serious murder cases. I mean, in your experience, is it also used sometimes in, I don't know, burglaries, robberies, frauds, or...
Well, lots of judges, when they're giving the summing up and they're trying to explain to the jury what a joint enterprise is, they'll give the jury the bank robbery scenario, which is, you know, these are men who have planned that they're going to rob a bank. One of them's going to go in and the other one's going to be outside in a getaway car. And it's a plan. You know, that is understandable to me, that even the getaway driver is part of this gang that is going to rob a bank. Whether he goes into the bank or not is immaterial. Now, judges are explaining that is the concept of joint enterprise in cases where there are 30 seconds maximum of violence that was not planned, that was not organised, that may have only erupted between a couple of people where one of the numbers has gone beyond the scope. So it's not a joint enterprise. So when the judges are describing the bank robber scenario, they're tricking the jury into thinking that whatever's happened in this particular instance that is on trial is all planned and organised, but it's not.
Can I just come in there and just use an example? So as Jan says, a spontaneous act of violence is completely different to a planned robbery. And a practitioner that I interviewed, so somebody who was a barrister, was speaking about young people who carry out violence in the context of joint enterprise cases. They said to me, well, it's not really spontaneous when they're a gang, is it? Because they're a gang. That's their purpose. They're out ready for this to happen. And so it just goes to show, although this gang evidence is often rooted in bias, it's completely flawed, it's racist, this gang narrative still does a lot of work in getting these convictions, in that even in cases of spontaneous violence, because the associations between these young people is seen to be criminal associations, they're not just friends to this prosecutor, they're able to say, doesn't matter if it was spontaneous, they have a common intention no matter what.
So they don't have to prove that group of young people have like planned and actually committed previous crimes or anything like that?
The judge will often say in his or her directions that assistance could happen at any point. It could be a wink, it could be a nod, it could be a last minute decision. So judges also tell jurors that it doesn't have to be pre-planned hours before.
And that is where defendants fail. They go into the courtroom defending themselves against murder. I didn't murder anyone. I can prove I didn't murder anyone. And they can do that because they can prove they didn't have the knife, the gun, or commit the violence. It's only at the end of the trial when the judge is telling the jury about knowing looks, a nod and a wink, and all this nonsense. I mean, how do you bag up a nod and a wink and put that before a jury? You know, who saw that nod and that wink and decided what it meant? And it's too late. Once you get to the summing up, it's too late. I used to say years ago to young people who were on trial, if I could speak to them beforehand, you have to stand there and say, I did not plan this. I did not foresee what my co-defendant would do. And I had no idea.
Mm. I mean, there was an important test case, wasn't there, a few years ago, the Jogi case, which did, to an extent, change the way the law works in these kinds of cases. What did it change? Nisha, did it make any great difference?
On paper, yeah. So you now have to intend to assist or encourage the principal, the person who carries out the offence, to be liable. Whereas before, mere foresight was enough to hold somebody liable. So foresight of the principal's actions. However, cases are still being articulated in the exact same way, in my opinion. So it's still this, they're all in it together narrative. Foresight still can be used as evidence of intent. And then there's also kind of, what is the line between foresight and intent? No one's really made that clear. What is intent? So I think not much has changed in practice, only on paper.
Nisha, there seems to be a kind of growing trend to use conspiracy, not technically joint enterprise, as the kind of legal doctrine or what the prosecution uses. And that was used in a recent case in Manchester of a group of boys who were messaging each other after the murder of one of their friends. Can you just describe that case and how they've used conspiracy in that case?
Yeah, I'll say though that I can't say if conspiracy is being used more so than it was before. But yeah, with the 10 boys who were convicted in Manchester, the difference between joint enterprise and conspiracy is that all the defendants are seen to be principals. They're not secondary parties. They are all said to have participated in a plan to commit an offence and intend for that offence to take place. But the offence doesn't have to have taken place. So they don't need any proof that they've actually done anything. In this case, they were able to use conspiracy because there were 10 boys who had participated in a Telegram chat, some of whom have only sent a few messages.
So for people who don't know what Telegram is, you probably might need to explain that.
It's kind of like a version of WhatsApp, yeah.
Okay, so they were on Telegram, and what were the messages about?
So they were discussing the death of their friend and who was responsible for it. And there were discussions about finding these people, basically. So the prosecution's case was that they were planning a so-called revenge attack. And that was the case that was presented to the jury at trial.
And they were prosecuted for conspiring to do this revenge attack. And then they were convicted of what?
Some of them were convicted of conspiracy to commit GBH and others were convicted of conspiracy to commit murder. I must say no one that was mentioned in the chat, that was named in the chat, was harmed. So I think only one of the boys carried out some harm, but it wasn't against a person that was named in the chat, as far as I'm aware.
So basically we've got a group of people who know each other who were just chatting on the equivalent of WhatsApp, and they are convicted and spending kind of a long time, presumably in prison.
Decades when there is no victim. These were young people who were grieving. And this is a platform that they share together where they discuss how they feel emotionally. And the prosecution's case, again, in this trial was very much oriented towards proving they were a gang, convincing the jury that they were all gang members. They used lyrics. They used lyrics from drill music to convince the jury that these were evil young people, even though there was no victim.
What do you think they should have done, the police, when with these sorts of messages that they came across? Was there anything they should have done and got involved with? Could they have been charged with something, or do you think it was just a totally wrong use of police powers?
It was pointless. I mean, there was an incident where I think it was two boys, I'm not quite sure, who committed some violence. And it was only after taking their mobile phones that they linked themselves to the other boys. It was unnecessary. It was cruel and unnecessary to do this to them. It really was.
And we should ask ourselves why we're responding to expressions of grief through a criminal justice response in the first place. Is it even necessary if no harm has taken place and the majority of the young boys haven't committed any harm?
Nisha, you've looked at a number of these cases as part of your research, and you've definitely identified that there is a kind of a racist component to some of the decision making. Is that right?
Yeah, I've so far spoken to just under 20 young black men and teenagers who've been convicted as a secondary party to murder. So none of them have carried out the acts themselves. And all but one said that the gang narrative was either explicitly used or alluded to at their trial. So because judges are becoming more attuned to the prejudices of using that language, prosecutors, to get around that, will feed into these narratives about the typical gang construct of postcode wars and tit-for-tat violence. And the reason that it's racist is because it's ultimately black youth culture on trial. So I've had practitioners say to me, I've asked them, how do you identify a gang? And this practitioner said to me, well, you know, some of them have near uniforms. They wear Chicago Bulls baseball caps or a particular tracksuit. And I'm like, that is just youth culture. How did you come to that conclusion? And so there's a really racialized understanding of this concept of gangs that has kind of permeated institutional practices. And it's become embedded within institutional practice. So I had a practitioner say to me that as soon as there's a murder and there is a young black boy involved, it must be a gang crime. There's been a death, joint enterprise, let's go for all of them. And she said, I don't think anyone even questions it anymore.
And by practitioner, you mean a defence solicitor who's representing some of these boys?
I mean either a barrister that does either prosecution or defence work. So the person I'm referring to here did both prosecution and defence work.
But presumably the defence tries to challenge these narratives and stereotypes and so on.
Yeah, so I would argue actually that the defence, although some of them do a really good job, most of them are doing the prosecution's work for them without realising, because the defence, in defending their client, will say, no, my client is not a gang member. The rest of them are. And so actually in doing that, the defence is accepting that gang narrative and saying, actually, yeah, most of these boys are a gang, just not my client. I think they don't often know that there are expert witnesses that can give evidence that challenge the prosecution's gang narrative or their interpretation of drill lyrics. So I interviewed a young boy recently who said that a police expert came to kind of decode his drill lyrics and claim that he was rapping about the events that had taken place. And the officer was getting every other line was completely wrong. And he said, I'm the expert in drill. How is an officer telling me what I meant by my lyrics? And I asked him, did your defense try and find an expert to kind of rebut what the officer was saying? And he said, no, we didn't know that was possible.
Nisha's talked powerfully about the part that race plays in a lot of the recent prosecutions. Jan, I just want to sort of clarify that the Jack Woodley case, where the 10 children were convicted, that was all white children, wasn't it? So there are still joint enterprise cases across the racial spectrum.
Yeah, all white working class children. It's young working class boys and black and Asian young people.
Nisha, you were going to say something.
Yeah, so I think it was in 2009, New Scotland Yard released a video that was put out in schools that basically warned young people what could happen to them if they were present when a serious violent incident took place. And it was really like a harsh video that basically said, if you're involved in any way, shape or form, we will come for you. And so you've got to look at it from a policy level. Why is it being used specifically for these cases?
So it's a kind of explicitly deterrent approach to actually say to young people, if you find yourself in a situation, you can end up facing extremely serious charges and many, many years in prison. Therefore, stay away from going out in groups. Is that the message the police are trying to get across?
Yeah, but it doesn't work.
We're social animals. Do they want children to stay in their bedrooms for the rest of their lives and never go out? It's nonsense. And something can't be a deterrent that no one knows about. And young people don't know that you can get convicted of murder and not even be at the scene. You know, you can sit in your bedroom and not leave the house and still get convicted of murder.
I mean, Nisha, you've talked to a lot of these young men in prison. Do they feel that they have been subjected to miscarriages of justice, or is that putting it too strong?
Yeah, no, they do. And I think some of them have as well. I think that it's difficult because calling it a miscarriage of justice would imply that the law has been incorrectly applied or there's some other issue. But the law has often been applied how it's meant to be applied. There's an issue just with joint enterprise. Joint enterprise in itself is a miscarriage of justice, in my opinion. Some of them say, I'll take responsibility for something, but how am I sitting here for murder that I didn't know was going to happen and I didn't intend to happen? There was one boy, I think I mentioned his case earlier, he was 16 at the time, and he admitted to driving and he drove people somewhere. They got out and ultimately somebody was killed. He wasn't witness to it directly. And he wanted to take a manslaughter plea because he took some responsibility because he drove them there. And the prosecution wouldn't even accept his manslaughter plea. It's like they're really coming for these kids. They really, really want murder charges.
Jan, you've been campaigning for a change in the law for years. What or who makes you feel optimistic?
The women that I work with, because we are all women, and because we love our children and our husbands and our partners, and we want a better future for the next generation. And we need to get the politicians to start listening to us. And we need the public on side, because ultimately there'll be someone listening to this today who won't think that this could possibly ever happen to them. And they'll be giving me a phone call in a year's time.
Can I just say as well, the scale of this, even though the CPS don't keep data on it, which they should be, it's not something that's small. Jan will tell you, they receive cases every week. And even trying to speak to young people of a really specific criteria for my research, so it's young black or mixed race young men who were convicted at the age of 25 and under in the last 5 years, I have not had any trouble finding people that want to talk to me that fit that criteria. I speak to them all the time and they say there's loads of us in here.
Jan, Nisha just mentioned data. And you're trying to get the CPS to give you data. What do you want?
We want to know the ages, the ethnicity. I mean, we've been asking for this for the last 10 years at least, you know, through Freedom of Information requests, and they just won't give it to us. We have our data, and our data says that this is discriminatory and it's racist. And I'll keep saying that until someone can prove me wrong. You know, tell us what's happened since Jogi. Has anything changed? Has it got worse? Because we can't have a debate until we know.
The Centre for Crime and Justice was able to obtain some data on joint enterprise recently. It begins to imply that we are right in that racial and age disproportionality is huge. The problem still persists after Jogi, after the Supreme Court ruling, and nothing has changed in terms of how many people are being charged and convicted. And one of the key findings is that there is a 10% difference between the number of young black men convicted for homicide overall and the number of young black men convicted as secondary parties for homicide. And that statistical disparity does not exist for any other ethnic group in that way. So it shows something about the way in which joint multi-handed cases are being dealt with and that there is a racialized element to that.
Mm. Well, we've heard a lot of concerns about this whole area. We need to draw to a close. I mean, can I ask each of you, if you were Prime Minister or Justice Secretary and could make one change in this area, what would it be? Jan, what would you do?
Abolish. Someone who hasn't murdered anyone should never go to prison for murder, full stop. That's it. You can't reform this. You cannot reform it. And we've got more than enough laws that we can use in this country that are in legislation. So I would abolish joint enterprise, because you can't fix something that's as broken as this.
Anisha?
Yeah, I would tend to agree that I don't think it can be fixed, in that its purpose was very specific from a policy perspective, and that is why it is having a discriminatory impact. But I think what needs to really stop is allowing prosecutors to present evidence that is literally the non-criminal actions of young people. So their involvement in drill music, because it's an art form that is being used to convict young people of serious offences, and they're going to prison for decades.
And Rob, what would you do?
The Justice Committee in the House of Commons did a report 10 years ago, I think, into this. It's a complicated area. Maybe they need to do another investigation into this, maybe with the Law Commission, if they're the body that actually looks at how the law works. Whether abolishing it is the way to go, it may well be, but I think it will only happen after a thorough look at this area, and at the very least, that's what needs to happen.
The felony murder rule, which is a very similar concept after Derek Bentley's death penalty sentence, was abolished in this country. So if we can abolish something like that, we can definitely abolish a common law that is as bad as this, definitely.
Thank you, Jan, Rob and Nisha. For information about our guests and the Joint Enterprise cause, please see our programme notes. And if you like the podcast, do please rate us on your podcast platform and spread the word. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.